Well, good morning. For those of you that might be visiting Jacob's Well for the first time this morning, my name's Tom Ryan, and I'm not on the staff. I'm just one of the two interim preachers while we're in this transition phase as a church. And this is my last assigned Sunday as one of the two interim preachers, and I just need to say right off the bat that I have just loved the privilege of partnering with Eric Leifblad in this adventure. Eric's the other interim preacher, and the Kairos team, our music worship directors, Beth, gosh, what a phenomenal team we have, and a great staff at the church. And the elders for giving me the privilege of being in this place. If you'd told me 2 years ago that Tim would leave and then I would have the privilege of being part of the team to help our community through the transition, I would have told you you were smoking medically approved cigarettes, but a bad batch maybe. I wouldn't have believed it, you know. And this has just been wow, just wow. Jacob's Well, thank you. Elders, thank you. Staff, thank you. So, it's not about me, however, it's about Jesus and you. So, let's look at Psalm 130. Julie set us up when she did the announcements really well, the call to worship. She set us up perfectly for this psalm. And this psalm takes us into depths and darkness. You might be at a place in your life where as you look at yourself, you say, I don't know that I really can identify with the depth of cry here. Well, the Psalms are written for all of us, and they have something to teach us, and they're also a reservoir. They're a prayer book. There will come a time if there hasn't, and if there has, there will come again a time when Psalm 130 is a perfect prayer for your heart. It has something to teach all of us. So let's read it together, and then as is our custom, we'll discuss it for a few minutes and then make some remarks. Psalm 130, together. Out of the depths I cry to you, O Lord. O Lord, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to the voice of my pleas for mercy. If you, O Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand? But with you there is forgiveness, that you may be feared. I wait for the Lord, my soul waits, and in his word I hope. My soul waits for the Lord, more than watchmen for the morning, more than watchmen for the morning. O Israel, hope in the Lord, for with the Lord there is steadfast love, and with him is plentiful redemption. And he will redeem Israel from all his iniquities. All right, like last week's psalm, 8 verses, very short. Most of the Psalms of Ascent are relatively brief. And again, there's 15 Psalms of Ascent, Psalm 120 through 134. So if you want to take out a Bible that's in the rack in front of you, you can leaf through it and find this section of Psalms, and we're on 130. What do you see in this psalm this morning? What strikes your attention or imagination? What comes up as you think this over? Yeah.
I think it's interesting that in verses 1 and 2 it says, like, hey God, pay attention to me. And then normally when we ask for attention, then we just spout off all the garbage that's going on in our lives. But instead, the rest of it talks about the glory of God, not our own problems.
Yeah. And so the comment is, it starts off with, hey God, I need your attention. Please listen to what I've got to say. But then instead of reciting a list of things that are going on, how did you frame it? You put it in a good way.
It focuses on the goodness of God.
Yeah, the focus kind of really flips from where the psalmist or the writer is right to God. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. The comment is the concept of waiting really strikes us. We live in a society that's really about not waiting, minimizing wait. We'll get this lunch to you in X amount of minutes or it's free. You know, that kind of thing. Yeah. Anybody else? Oh, yeah, Brian. Yeah.
That instruction is really needy, desiring, you know, just wanting.
Yeah, the comment is that with this great cry of anxiety and pain, that there's this sense that, all right, this is my tragic situation, but I really believe you're hearing me. Hear my voice. Hear as I speak. Am I getting the gist of what you said? Because you said a lot of good stuff, Brian.
Yeah. That was the main thing. Just that desiring that one-on-one to me, like just tune in to what I need to say because I really need you.
Yeah. Holy One, tune into what I've got to say because I really need you. A good comment. Yeah. Somebody else? Yeah. Yeah, the comment is that the role of the earth and the sun, the morning does always in fact come. It may take a lot longer than we want it to. We may be in anxiety waiting for it, but it does come with certainty as the steadfast love of the Lord is there for us with certainty. Yeah, great comment. Anybody else? Okay. When this psalmist starts off with out of the depths, that word depths really corresponds to the human experience of despair, total despair, absolute despair. Out of total despair, am I crying to you, O God? Lord, hear my voice. When the Hebrews think about despair, in that Old Testament mindset, like we saw in our Psalm last week, 124, the whole idea of a flood or raging waters, torrents that sweep us away, floods that come over our head and engulf us, really gives a good picture in the Hebrew mindset of what despair is. It's really being engulfed, being overwhelmed, being in a death-like situation. I can't keep living this way. I won't survive this. You have to do something because I'm not surviving. I won't survive. I'm not sure I even want to survive. It's an absence of hope. When I think about both in the Bible and in our lives and in our community, what it means or what are the things that make for despair in our experience, in your lives and in our community, for some of us, we've gone through periods in our life or people close to us have where they've gone through physical pain. And the physical pain, particularly when it's acute or chronic in a certain way, can create a sense of hopelessness, a sense of despair, a sense of wanting to give up. For some of us, we've gone through phases of emotional pain where our feelings are just disjointed and separated from any sense of wholeness or goodness. And at the bottom of all things, hope. We've lost hope. And so our feelings, we're still in touch with them, but they're just absolutely despairing. They're empty. They're flat. They keep ranging around looking for something to grab onto. And you've seen folks that are in emotional chaos, and they'll grab onto really bad things. Some of us do that from time to time. But the person that's trying to live an integrated life, a whole life, and when it isn't working and when they're in emotional chaos, they'll hit despair. And sometimes when something's happened that assaults our own sense of self-esteem or self-honoring or self-awareness, our own sense of who we are, our goodness, maybe it's an adversary that comes after us. Maybe it's an ex-spouse that is saying bad things about us and running us down or making life hell for us in terms of trying to carry out joint parenting or something like that. There can be all kinds of assaults from the outside that hurt our sense of ourself, but sometimes it's our own interior guilt or false guilt or cycles that we can't identify in our own minds, and we'll find hope ebbing away, and when that happens, we'll hit despair. And Psalm 130 is our prayer. For some of us, it's rejection or it's failure, but always it's a lack of hope. Whatever the source of our despair, the panic or the terror we feel is rooted in the idea that either there might not be a God, maybe we're wrong about this whole idea, maybe there really isn't anything there. And let's be honest, a lot of us find ourselves wondering that question, thinking that question. That's not an absence of faith necessarily. That's an examination of faith. That's an important piece of faith. Or if we find our faith made real and whole, and so we assume that God is there, we then move to that place of, but for some reason God isn't paying attention to my situation. For some reason my despair doesn't matter to heaven. At the end of the day, the real crux of it is relational separation. It's the absence of hope comes from that sense of some kind of separation from God. Now, it's not simple, and there's no simple formula for it, but what it demands is the continuation and the pursuit of the relationship above everything else. And what this psalm is saying is that the psalmist is gambling, is willing to bet all the chips of life, that just as the morning comes, the steadfast love of God really will perform what only it can perform. It will come through for me, because that's God's nature. The relational separation from God might be about our sins, it might be about something else, but at the heart of God's steadfast love is forgiveness. At the heart of healing in the Old Testament is forgiveness. There's a writer that's old now, he's still alive, Frederick Buechner. Frederick Buechner put together a quote that's really, really good years ago on despair. And I think we have it on a slide. Despair has been called the unforgivable sin, not presumably because God refuses to forgive it, but because it despairs of the possibility of being forgiven. In life, thinking about that quote, in life, as human beings, we're wonderful creatures, and we're a mess. We're made in the image of God, and it's a pretty marred image. And so we can find ourselves in places where we presume to know or presume to anticipate what God's view of us really is. And we can get to that place of saying, I do believe there's a God, but for some reason I'm outside of God's reach. I do believe that God is love, but I don't think God's love means he's going to bring me through this. I do believe in God, but the kind of life I've lived or the choices I've made or the sins of my soul are such that heaven has put me on track B or C or D or doesn't even have a track for me. Despair is going to that place of saying, no, there's no possibility here. It's an absence of hope. Well, what the writer does is the writer cries out for a merciful hearing, but is keenly aware that the writer has no claim upon God. See, one could say that as a part of the covenant people of the old covenant, of the Old Testament, that there was a covenant made between God and Abraham, and then God through Moses, and then God through subsequent ratifications of that covenant. And so as the covenant people, they have a claim on God. But this writer is accurately sizing up the situation that the covenant people of God have broken that covenant. And so they don't actually have a legal claim anymore to say, okay, you'll be our God, we'll be your people, and we can count on you to bring us through the deep waters. No, no, no. And so the psalmist says, oh, Lord, if you mark iniquities, what one of us is going to be able to stand? What one of us is going to be able to stay alive in your presence if you really kept a record of all of our wrongs? And so the appeal of this psalm, Psalm 130, is to the divine character. It's an appeal to the forgiving character. It's an appeal to what Julie said in her call to worship this morning about the steadfast love. I was so delighted that she made a point this morning as we gather as a community to worship here at 9 about how much that phrase steadfast love appears in the Bible, particularly in the Psalms, in the Old Testament. It comes from a Hebrew word, hesed, and hesed is not the normal word for love between men and women or men and men or even men and God. It's a particular kind of love. It's a deep kind of love. The steadfast love or the hesed of Yahweh is divine mercy, divine loyalty, divine forgiveness. The psalmist is saying, I don't have a right to call on you. I don't have a legal claim upon your help here. I don't have an emotional, relational claim upon your heart here. But I know your nature is this, that among all your other attributes of holiness and justice and sovereignty and power, you are merciful and loyal and forgiving. Another wrinkle to hesed as we think about the steadfast love, the hesed of God. The hesed of God is the kind of love that's extended particularly when the object of that love is in a pitiful state, in a bad way, unable to do anything for itself. Well, that's Psalm 130, out of the depths, out of that place of despair, out of that sense of loneliness and abandonment, out of that place where I can no longer do anything for myself. Often the word hesed is linked to verbs. The steadfast love of a God does stuff. It's not just an attribute of God, it's an activity of God. It's not just attributes, it's acts. And so in the Old Testament, there is this portrayal of God being loyal and faithful and merciful, even when we're in a pitiful state, maybe even especially when we're in a most pitiful state. You've probably all heard this before, but if you'll bear with me, one of my favorite images in the Old Testament is in Genesis 15. Genesis 15 is that time when a man who will become known to us as Abraham is still called Abram. And Abram is sought out by the living God, and he calls him from a faraway place, and he says, I want to take you to another place where I'm going to make of you a great nation. And then there comes this particular scene between God and Abram in Genesis 15. To us, it's a strange scene. To Middle Easterners, it's a much more familiar scene. In the Hebrew, there's a phrase called a krath berith. It literally means to cut a covenant, to make a covenant. And so when two parties are going to make a very serious covenant, maybe it's a covenant of a land transaction or some other business deal or some other serious and important thing, they will each bring to this ceremony of cutting a covenant a set of animals, several animals. And this is going to be a little gory for some of you, but they cut the animals down the middle. They slay the animals, they kill them, and then they literally hack them down the middle so the animals are in two halves, split right down the middle. And then they lay one half on this side and the other half of the animals on this side. Gory? Yeah, pretty significant. I mean, you got the loss of some livestock, so you've got investment, and then you've got blood and gore. You've got all the makings of a really fine film. And so then the two parties will link arms, and they walk between the two, they walk in the avenue between the two halves of the animals, and they recite together what they have agreed to. So may the Lord do to me if I do not fulfill all the terms of this covenant. So may the Lord do to me if I do not fulfill all the terms of this covenant. That's a way of saying, gosh, I really, 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 really mean this, what I'm promising to do. And putting yourself legally, emotionally, in every sense on the line to fulfill your agreement. Genesis 15 is that moment where God's about to establish his covenant, his sacred covenant with Abram, who will become Abraham and become the father of the Hebrews and become the one, the people for Yahweh. And so he cuts a covenant with Abraham. But in Genesis 15, what happens? He tells Abram to bring the animals. He does. Tells him to cut them and prepare the sacrifice. He does. But then Abram falls into a deep, deep sleep. God puts him in a deep sleep. Abram is not able to walk between the animals with God. But mysteriously, a smoking torch and a fire pot appear in the night. And they move between the animals. And these are tokens of Yahweh, saying, I'm making a covenant with you you can't fulfill. I am creating a relationship that you do not have within yourself what it takes to make this happen. But I'm still making it, and I will promise for both of us. So if, in fact, you fail, then it's on me. I will take your penalty. Genesis 15 sets every earnest seeker for God up to the cross. Because the cross of Jesus Christ, the act of Jesus, the God-man, coming and living among us, living and then fulfilling the covenant, is Genesis 15. And what that does is that makes it possible for you and for me to re-engage God in a covenant relationship. Do we still despair? Yes. Do we find the floods over our heads? Absolutely. Do we have times when our guilt and our remorse is so great we feel like we're choking? You know that we do. Do we see that our lives are actually out of control, that as wonderful as this world is, it's crazy and chaotic, and there are things way beyond our control, and sometimes the fears at night keep us awake? Yes. And yet, out of the depths, we can say, oh God, are you hearing my voice? No, I know that you are. Last week, our psalm was a testimony of what God's done, but this week, it's different. This week, the psalmist is still actually in the midst of the struggle, and it's impossible to know with any certainty exactly how this situation will unfold for the psalmist. Given the basics of the psalmist's appeal, here she's still in the immense struggle. Danger is still lurking around, still fearful of the darkness and the threat, and waiting for God's deliverance. You know, often when we're in difficult situations and we talk to another person that's close to us or that's a good friend and they say, how are you doing? I was really wondering about your situation, and we go through it, or we talk about what we're struggling with. If we start to get to those places of despair, the other wants to help. But oftentimes what we get is consolation. Oh, that's so terrible. My brother went through that. I know that's really painful. Oh, I'm so sorry. I went through one of those myself. Oh, I know what you're feeling. Sincere, but it doesn't change anything. And it doesn't necessarily give hope that you're going to be okay. When people say, you'll be fine, it's going to be okay, everything's going to be fine, they're there now. If we're still intact with our mental faculties in the pits of despair, we say to ourselves, you're saying that because you want it to be true, but you have no power to make it so. You don't know if everything's going to be okay. It's going to hell right now, and it's 4/5 of the way there. It's a little late to be issuing platitudes. Do you know what I'm saying? Some of you do. All of you will. Yeah. Never had a gift of prophecy, not prophesying, it was a thing that preachers did. We say so many things that God have mercy upon us. James 3:1, let not many of you become teachers, because as such you shall incur a greater judgment. Sometimes we get advice. Well, did you try this? Did you do that? What about this? Or, you know, how do I solve this? How do I rescue you? How do I get you out of this situation? Perhaps sometimes we even get forensic speculation. Well, what did you do to get in this predicament? They're asked subtly these questions, but what really the person's asking for is, how do I avoid ending up where you are? You know, Psalm 130 tells us what we really need is love. What we really need is the four-letter word love, and spelled W-I-T-H with an H-O-P-E, hope. That's what we really need. If you're walking with somebody that's in the pits of despair, pray Psalm 130 for them and with them. And don't give them platitudes, and don't tell them it'll be okay. Don't tell them you know how they feel, because you don't know how they feel. You can anticipate how you might feel. You know how you have felt, but you don't know how they feel. But what you can do is go to Psalm 130 and say, the night's long. An ancient watchman that were positioned in the city towers had a long and a lonely night with a lot of danger out there. And they longed to see the breaking of dawn. That was always a highlight, to see that dawn had come again and the foe had not overwhelmed them, that the dangers had stayed away. They longed for the morning. More than that, we long for the rescue of God. But the rescue of God is present and is promised because of who God is. I know this psalm. I've preached on it before. I've read Peterson's book on Along Obedience in the Same Direction years ago. I've listened to it set to music in different ways. I've journaled on this psalm. I've rewritten this psalm in my own language. I didn't pick it. Eric did this series and assigned it to me. And I was struck. I was just struck because this psalm has become my prayer. It's become my own. Though it's been my privilege, really, to have faith since I was a little person and to walk with Jesus from the early years of my life, I've struggled my whole life with depression and anxiety, with self-destructive behaviors. I'm 54. I'll turn 55 in a few weeks. And all of my adult life, I'd say probably most of my entire life, shame and self-loathing have been my constant companions. I've preached on the love of God. I've believed in the love of God. I've pled the love of God. I've shared the love of God. I've seen God use me to convey his love to others. And I felt loved, but still shame and self-loathing were part of my steps. And then these last 3 years, if it wasn't bad before, I went to the depths, the absolute depths. And then Psalm 130 became mine. I carved my own initials in the trunk of Psalm 130. There was a verse in Luke that came to me during that period that came off the page. It said, Jesus is talking to Peter. He's telling Peter he's going to turn his back on Jesus the night of Jesus' own suffering. And he says, Simon, Satan's demanded to have you that he could sift you like wheat, but I prayed for you that your faith will not fail. And as dark as it got, it was still Psalm 130 because my faith didn't leave me. I despaired of my own life, but God never quite left me. For quite a while, I was in a place so dark, so absent of light, so bereft of hope, purpose, and meaning, that all desire left. And yet this prayer remained. God was the God of my whole life. God was God over my darkness as well as my light. God heard my prayer. fact, it turns out that God was beside me the whole time. I just wasn't aware. And he brought me out of the depths. Out of the depths, oh God, do we call unto you? Oh God, with you there is steadfast love. Amen.